Okay, welcome to episode 163 of an Evolving Man podcast. Today I'm excited to be speaking to Dominic Waterson. Dominic is a researcher, podcaster, author, and co-host of the Sheep Farm podcast. Over the last several years, he has become known for his deep dive investigations into politics, power, institutions, media, and elite networks. His recent book, Traitors, The Pandemic Politicians, examines the backgrounds, influences, education, and decision making of key political figures during the COVID era. Drawing on thousands of hours of research, Dom explores themes of power, leadership, institutional culture, childhood experiences, and the hidden forces that shape society. Through his writing and podcasting, he encourages people to question assumptions, think critically, and examine the systems that influence our lives. Thank you, Dom.
Thanks for having me on, Piers. That was some introduction.
It's cool, isn't it?
If
It's
only my
like,
mum was here to hear that.
yeah. Well, I mean, your book, Traitors, I mean, it's a pretty impressive tome. Was it 650 odd pages or something? No, 550 pages.
It would have been more. We had to condense the source notes down.
Yeah.
The lady that helped me design the interior. We had to reduce the font by 25% because there was 180 pages of source notes at the same font size, so it sort of halved the number of pages.
Wow, amazing. Yeah, so I'd love for you to begin just by sharing what drew you to write the book, to start getting into this area.
I always like to book the system, if want of a better term, but I'm an uneducated lad, I suppose. I left school with no qualifications in Huddersfield. And I thought, you know what, why can't I be an author? I always think these things. Why can't I do podcasts? I'm not trained to do all this stuff. Same with business. So I wanted to write a book for many years. I've always read books from being a young lad, whether it's about football or moving on to other stuff. So I always wanted to write a book. I suppose people call it a bucket list, but mine's just. I'm not saying I'm going to write another one, but that's why, just to prove that I could do it, really, to myself. And so the information comes from in 2020 when me and Chris, my brother Chris, started the podcast up. The research I'd done into certain individuals, I tried coming up with a format that'd work in a book form using the information I'd gathered together over 4, 5, 6 years, and I had to split it down into three areas, really. I had the politicians, I had the medical and media experts, and I had the World Economic Forum. So I've actually got the same amount of information on each of those subjects. So the medical experts, if I do another book, it'll be the medical experts and the media experts that sort of drove the fear in the pandemic. So Chris Whitty and Valance and Van Tam and people like that. I know I'm going off piste a little bit there.
No, not at all. It's really fascinating because I listened to a few podcasts of yours over the last few weeks, and you mentioned about potentially doing a second and third book. And as you mentioned the names, because obviously what drew me to reach out was you talking about boarding schools and how many of them have been to boarding school. And obviously, that's an area I've been fascinated with for about 20 years after my own experiences. So when you say Whitty, I'm like, oh, he went to boarding school age 9. And Valance was at a boarding school. I can't find the data if he actually was a boarder. And so many of the media, Rupert Murdoch went to boarding school. So it's fascinating as you say that. It's like, and as I was reading through your book, I was reading it at the weekend. I had my phone out and I would go onto Wikipedia or their website and just say, oh, did that person go to boarding school? And I'm like, my God, almost 70% of the people you talk about in that book have been to boarding school. So I'm just fascinated to speak to you.
What is strange, that I'm totally non-political. I don't vote, never voted. I was brought up in a conservative household, ironically. My dad was a local butcher, and so he always voted conservative. A working class guy from Dewsbury, a mill town not far from Huddersfield. And he always voted Tory, but my mum's side, her my grandfather would be a stepfather because my mum were black. He was a labor union leader. So Christmas dinners were always interesting. They were always arguing about politics, and I thought it all sounds like nonsense to me. So when people say to me, why write about politics? And I think, well, politics is, it's one of the things that is used as a controlling element in our lives all through generations. And why not look into the backgrounds of who these people are tied to, paid for by? And I couldn't find the ones I looked into, I couldn't find one that you'd trust very much.
I so agree. I think in the documentary, Alex Renton says, you know, who are you beholden to? It's to your class, as in the people you went to school to, cool with. So they're not beholden to the people.
They're beholden to the system, aren't they? The state of whatever, I'll use Britain as an example, whatever England that it is, they're beholden to that. And you can see that it doesn't matter now what color people are. Normally it used to be white British people, but it doesn't matter because the Conservative leader, she's singing the same words that 30 years ago you wouldn't have expected a black person to say, you know? And yeah, they just all sing from the same hymn sheet. And when you look into the backgrounds of who pays them, and again, I might be going off piste a little bit here, but Boris Johnson was paid by the Bamford family who own JCB. I didn't do a lot of digging into the Bamford family, but I know that they come from an esteemed family, let's say. But they, one of their biggest sales internationally is to Israel. And they use their JCBs to flatten the West Bank. So the biggest trade, in, one of the biggest international trades with JCB is with the IDF. Boris Johnson obviously went to Israel quite a lot. What I'm trying to say is, you see these patterns with all of these people, not just Israel, but with all the, that are linked to secret organizations, like Nadeem Zahawi, for instance. He was the president of a secret group called Le Cercle. They're in it. They were set up by the intelligence community, British intelligence mainly, and French.
Who's Nadeem Sahawa?
Nadeem Zahawi was the
Is the what?
2020 vaccine
Yeah.
man minister.
Of course. Yeah.
And he, I mean, these people call it corruption. I don't look at it as corruption. This is the how this parasitical system seems to work. It's game theory. And that's why I called it Traitors, because Traitors, the TV program, I've never watched it, but I did read their pages about what it meant. It basically meant lying and cheating to the top. And and so game theory is that, and that's how this world seems to run, on game theory. Whoever can inflict the most pain and suffering seems to rise to the top. It's like playing Grand Theft Auto, isn't it? It seems.
It is. It's interesting you're saying about corruption. I've always grown up believing that Britain was a very trustworthy place and there was no corruption here. And then over the last 10 years, I've, through doing my research, just like questioning that. And then I read Oliver Bullock's book,
Not read
which
that,
is
no.
about Butler to the World, which is all about the London money system. And I don't know if it's there, but I read something about, I've forgotten the name, Robert, who was Roberto Marciano. A Italian journalist who'd worked a lot with corruption across the world, mafiosa, so much so that he had a bodyguard 24/7 keeping him alive because the mafiosa in Italy were trying to kill him. And he was asked, where is the most corrupt place in the whole world? And I'm like, immediately, well, it must be Uganda, Philippines, one of these
Nigeria,
places,
yeah,
Nigeria,
whatever.
total corrupt. He says, the most corrupt place in the world is England, and in particular, London. And I'm like, what? And he says, because a lot of the dirty money in the world goes through London.
Yeah, and it's renowned, isn't it? I mean, what was the film that was done when the Panama Papers came out. There was a film done, I forget what it's called now, but it showed that all that system was set up post World War II, probably thought about pre World War II, that made Britain look small and weak and it's just not cricket, you know. We wouldn't harm anybody, and we've become this country where we seem to be soft, and you know, I hear people saying we're just a soft touch is England, letting all these immigrants in, and we're just soft touch. And I think one thing that England isn't and never has been, especially in the last 300 years, is a soft touch. And we can be accused of many things, but not a soft touch. We've literally killed tens of millions of people from this country. And I think that bears a heavy price on the people that live here as well. Because the East India Company, I mean, a lot of these people's genetics, when you go through the bloodline, they're all linked to, I'm saying they're all linked to, a lot of them are linked to the East India Company as well, and companies like that. So whether they're still financially paid out of that East India Company, wherever it is now, I don't know. I never thought, but some of it must still be flushing around the system somewhere. Some people made a lot of money out of that. I mean, in some of my research, I remember when they banned slavery in Britain, they paid off all the slave owners to release the slaves, which didn't really happen. What happened was they did release the slaves, but the slaves had nowhere to go, so they ended up working for the same masters. Yeah, and they were the loan that paid off the slave owners was borrowed by the British government from the bank, the Rothschild Bank. Yeah, and we only paid that loan off in 2015. Some would call it corruption, but that's how it, going back to what that the guy that wrote Butler to the World, that is what happens. That is the game, if as no doubt these people think it is. I mean, Boris Johnson, when he left office, he earned £5 million that year,
It's incredible.
which, great if you can get it, but he earned £5 million. Not, it should have been dragged over the coals.
I heard some really fascinating statistic about that £5 million is someone did some research and looked at all of the former prime ministers who give speeches, who went to boarding school, and I don't know, I think this is the last 20 years, they have kept all their money who when they've been speaking. So Boris kept that 5 million. But the one who didn't, which was Gordon Brown, he's given, whenever he speaks, he gives all his money to charity. All the others, Tony Blair, David Cameron, they've kept all the money. And it's fascinating to kind of, and it's, I spoke to on my podcast, Richard Grannan, who wrote about narcissism. And he says, boarding schools create narcissists. It's all about us because there's no one to care for us. We disappear inside of ourselves. So it's like, and I can see that with Boris, is that if he doesn't have attention, he doesn't exist. And so he's got to be seen all the time.
Yeah, and I think Tony Blair's in that camp as well, because I've never there's never been a prime minister that's wheeled out as much as Tony Blair is still. They don't even I've not even an American president's wheeled out as much as Tony Blair. Everything that goes on, he seems to get wheeled back out again for, as the he's going to be leader of this peace, whatever, and leader of the Israeli, Palestine, wherever, and constantly wheeled out to do things as some kind of czar. And a lot of these guys went through the World Economic Forum Young Global Leaders as well. That's another, like Boris Johnson didn't actually go through that, ironically. But Tony Blair did, and a few of the other ones did. But Boris Johnson did go to some of the meetings, World Economic Forum meetings and the Young Global Leader meetings as well.
Well, maybe let's begin there, just looking at some of these childhoods, because that's what kind of really I was fascinated by. Because looking at your research, say, for example, if we begin with Boris, What was his childhood like?
The guy wrote a book called, it was called Tom Bower. It was about Boris Johnson while he was in power. And he, I mean, even before he went, even without school, he was brought up in a volatile, violent household. His dad apparently was a bit of a flanderer with other women as well, which that does sort of come out in Boris's life throughout as well. He, in his adult life, he also broke his mother's nose. Sorry, he broke his wife's nose, did Stanley. And she had a mental breakdown several times and was put in mental institutions while Boris was a 10-year-old, that age group, you know, younger. And then he was shipped off from the Brussels school, which many famous people went to the Brussels school as well when Stanley were working for the EU. The Cruella de Vil lookalike, what she called the president of the EU, currently with the white hair, forget what she's called now. She was at that school as well. Ursula von der
Cool.
Leyen, yeah. And so Boris was shipped off to the same school where Tim Renton was.
It's Alex Renton.
Alex Renton, sorry, why do I keep calling him Tim? Anyway, Alex Renton, where Alex Renton went to Ashdown House. And Boris on his blog states on his blog that he was beaten with basically every implement, from a cane to a jockery bat, and which I had to look up because I never, but it's like a rounder's bat, and a nine iron golf club, he said. I kid you not, he said at the end of that. This was on his blog, which has since been taken down, which has been there from the early 2000s. And right up to last year. Fortunately, I've got copies of the pages. And it looks like it's been taken off the Wayback Machine as well.
What's the Wayback Machine?
Well, the Wayback Machine is a historical download, a cache of everything that's been on the internet. But in 2020, they started deleting records so people couldn't find that. It was initially it was open to more or less everybody. And then they started deleting records, I think, due to what was going on in 2020, because people were looking at certain things. But Boris Johnson, I can't find it on there. Maybe somebody can find it and send it me over. But it was BorisJohnson.com, and that doesn't exist now. Or the
How
website doesn't,
interesting.
yeah. But
Yeah,
that
I
was,
never
sorry.
knew about that, about the website, because I never looked at that. I mean, I've certainly got a couple of books by about Boris's. One
Right,
is
yeah.
that one.
Right.
This is the more interesting one, the Just
Right.
Boris.
Right.
But I didn't realize that there was a website there where he talked about it, because he doesn't talk about it much, about
No.
the beating. Also, I think there's the guy Conrad Black in one of the biographies said the only time Boris was serious when you started talking about corporal punishment, then he was like, right, he'd get really passionate. And it was like, well, I think she says in the book, well, what happened to him?
And Conrad Black had a dodgy past as well. And I think he was one of his mentors at one point.
That's it,
Con
the Telegraph. So he was the editor.
It was strange as well through, well, we'll just veer off. His first job, he got sacked for lying. I think it's a well-known story, or plagiarism, or whatever you want to call it. And yet he gets more jobs. I mean, surely as a journalist, if you get, that's like the Holy Grail, isn't it? If you get sacked for making stories up, I would have thought you'd had a black mark on your name forevermore. But he seems to have been able to lie his way to the top. And he's got an upward trajectory of earnings and career, right up to the point of being prime minister. And openly lying as well, caught out multiple times on video and in interviews that he's basically lied. And yet he's willing just to stand there like nothing's happened. Me and you would be as embarrassed as hell and probably never go out of the door again. But he's quite openly open about it. Well, that is it. I mean, that is a trait, isn't it? That's the tra when we talk about narcissism, that's a definite trait.
Yeah, and I think Nick Duffel talks about that quite a bit in Wounded Leaders, and also the making of them. That's one of the traits which comes out of boarding school, is that we have a lie, which is almost the strategic survival personality, which is the defense mechanism. And mixes, there's three things. You're either a complier, a rebel, or you're a crushed, you know. And most of us are kind of compliers, and we put up this defense, which is, I don't feel anything, you know, workaholism, you know. But we therefore we find it really difficult to admit lies, because then that starts to break down this defense mechanism. So we just go, nope. And you know, he gives the example in the book about David Cameron. And this is more about anger. I think it's in question time, where someone just goes to him at question time, oh, you've said something wrong or lied. And David Cameron gets really angry. He's, oh, shh, be quiet, or something like that. And you're like, whoa, that's a really big. He says, calm down to
Right.
her. And it's like, what?
Because he's normally got a very calm demeanor, Cameron, hasn't he? He holds it in, holds it together quite well. But you can tell, again, behind that facade, you can tell a lot of these guys are acting. They're not actually, like we're just having a conversation now. That a lot of it's an act for them. It's like they're living another persona.
Well, maybe I put into context here. When my father died, I was on his deathbed, and this was 2000, year 2000, and I told my father that I'd always felt he was an ex-boarder, military captain, military commander, and I said to him, I always felt like you hated me. And he burst into tears
Oh,
and he said, I'm so sorry, my whole life's been an act. My whole
oof.
life's been a
Pretty
lie.
powerful that. That's, I don't know how old he was at that particular point, but
He was
imagine holding all that together.
57.
Right.
So it's like, I think it is that it's like we're acting. That's what we learned to do. I was great at acting. Some of the best actors are ex-boarding school. Benedict Cumberbatch, he's an ex-boarder. You know, there's quite a lot out there because we learn to put on the mask.
You have to do, if you're sent there at 6 years old, for instance, into a dorm with other 6 year olds that are just all like in the your film crying, you have to put a mask on or sink pretty quick.
So anything else about Boris there, in like his childhood, or I mean, obviously you probably could talk for 2 hours about the
Well, I mean,
research.
in the book, there's 15 chapters on Boris. There's not 15,
15.
15,
Wow.
yeah. There's on Boris's life. So that could have been a book in its own right. And so Boris Johnson's, Stanley Johnson, was the driving force really behind Boris, I would have said. And he looks up to Stanley to the point where he wanted to give him a knighthood. And it's one of the only times that someone. Obviously, when a prime minister's leaving, they can give knighthoods as part of their whatever they call it. I forgot what they call it now, but and it was sort of said you can't give him a knighthood. That's how bad they thought of Stanley. He wasn't part of that club, even though he had the bloodlines or whatever you want to call it. He was obviously wasn't part of a particular club, but Stanley went to a boarding school as well. And was abuse at his school. And when he sent Boris to Ashdown, he didn't just send Boris there, he sent Rachel and all the other children went there. I do believe, I don't know if the youngest went there, but anyway, of that. But Rachel was the first girl at Ashdown House. And he never even went to the school to check it. Bear in mind, his wife's in a mental institute undergoing electric shock treatments and God knows what else she was drugged out of her head. And he never went to check it. He just rang up and said, "She, I'm sending my daughter as well." And so, what power did he have behind him to be able to tell a school, a high-end private school, that I'm sending a girl, whether you like it or not? That is some. I mean, he did work for John D. Rockefeller III. Maybe that had something to do with it directly on population control. Did Stanley. And in Boris's blogs, he talked about population control as well, and eugenics. That's another thread that seems to run through a lot of these transhumanism, eugenics, population control. They seem to like talking about the rest of the population like we're some kind of cattle or sheep to be prodded and bought whenever we want to do, but whenever they want to do. But Boris's childhood, like I said, he hated school. He hated it. He said that in his blogs. He didn't like it. Tony Blair said the same thing. And you told me a story about Tony Blair that I didn't know either, which but then fitted in with everything else that I wrote about Tony Blair. But Boris's school life, when he went to, he was an underachiever as well. I think he struggled at school. I don't think academically he fit in at school. And I don't know if that's a trait that goes through a lot of these people. I call it, in society we have a, at the moment, maybe it's been going on for longer, what I call the worship of mediocrity. It seems to be that people who shout the loudest get promoted more, and not necessarily, they're not necessarily the ones that have got the skill set to do that role, whatever it might be, whether it's pop music, whether it's acting. Some people are elevated, let's say, or controlled, maybe because they're easier to manipulate by unseen hands or forces. And I think throughout Boris's life, it seemed, and I'll use the word seemed, I'm not saying it's definite, that he was greased in the tracks, if you like, to become who he became. Now, maybe there were several people they were greasing to become a prime minister at the same time. I'm not saying it was just Boris Johnson, but it seems that these people are placed there. And it is like a cookie cutter. I remember a story someone told me. I won't mention the name of the person that told me, but he's been on our podcast. He said that, going back to Valence, they all worked together, and Valence was fast-tracked. He was a corporate man in this is in university, and they couldn't understand why he was being fast-tracked when he weren't as good as this chap or his peers.
I wonder whether it is to do with that. Maybe there's some other reason I don't know, but I've often seen this in my life with the school you went to or who your family is. And I, for example, went for a job in the city, and the guy looked at my CV and he says, "Oh, I went to the school next door to that." Yeah, you've got the job. You
Deal.
know, and it's almost like it's an unseen omerta. They know what you've been through, and it's like, yeah, we'll let you in. And if you have the right accent and if you have the right name, and you kind of get in. I mean, I said when we were talking before we began about Oxford. So from a private school, it's changed now, but this is Robert Verkaik, who's a journalist who talks about this in Posh Boys. He says, if you go to a private school, so or boarding school, it's one in 20 who goes to boarding school, who goes to Oxford or Cambridge, sorry. So
Right.
from public school, one in 20 goes on to Oxford or Cambridge. And from a state school, it is one in 2,000.
Wow.
And he points out in the book, if you look at the bookies' odds for Bono becoming Pope, it's the same odds. Then he's like, that's ridiculous. And
Yeah.
it's changed. It's kind of, but that's how it's been for the last few 100 years. And, you know, Winchester had a deal that they were sending people, I think it was to Oxford. So if you went to Winchester, then it was a fast track to Oxford, for example. I think some of the other schools it was a fast track to Cambridge. And it's like it's just fascinating that it's totally biased. If you went to a state school, the chances of you getting in to Oxford or Cambridge is very low.
Yes. Yeah. And Boris Johnson's father put him through Ashdown, and then because he wanted him to get into Eton to get into Oxford. But all his qualifications weren't fantastic. He wasn't, Tony Blair's was the same. They weren't high achieving academically to get there. I'm sure that if in the country there would have been people around who, I mean, I weren't academic either. So I'm sure there are people at my school more academic than they were. Now, would they have turned out any different? Probably not. Because I think they get put through these systems. And they might start out with the best ideas, want to get into politics, want to be a lawyer, I'll sort out crime, I want to be a police commissioner, whatever it might be. And when they get there, they've been the tentacles of whoever's funding them or advising them or whatever has made that much of a difference to them. They're not the same person that they were with the same morals or values when they get up to the top. And I've been in business with people like that. They can't live up to what life should be like. You don't have to be a total twat to be successful.
No, and I
Being
think
blunt.
that's what a lot of my work is now, is like around leadership, is like working with leaders and telling them that you don't need to be the command and control leader anymore. That doesn't work. The Gen Z will just leave. If you're on horrible to them, they won't stay. You need to be more compassionate, create a culture of safety, be kind. When you do that, suddenly staff retention goes up, productivity goes up, innovation goes up. And yet I hear so many companies in the UK are still doing the command and control style of leadership, and they're wondering why they're struggling.
People don't want to work in that environment anymore. Just like when I started out, it was fantastic having a suit on and a tie. It felt important and what have you. And you're a professional, that type of thing. And then it changed. People now do Zoom meetings in a hoodie and a pair of shorts and some flip flops. It's how it is. And they just get the
Are
work
you
done the
wearing
same.
shorts and
I've got
shorts?
shorts. I've got trainers on though. I haven't got flip flops on, but I've got shorts
Nice.
on. But they do, don't they?
100%, 100%.
And when you went for that interview, it reminded me when we mentioned that interview about, oh, I went to that school you're in. Sanjay Javid is probably someone who's not didn't fit in. Sanjay Ja or Savage Javid, as I call him. He didn't fit in because I remember he saying he went to Rothschild's bank for a job, and when they found out what schools he'd went been to, they didn't want him.
No.
So he went round. He went to an American bank, and but his background isn't, even though he comes from a Lancashire working class background, he's ended up the same type of person.
And it's what I wonder if it's kind of like, in order to succeed in that world, well, you have to be like everybody else. You have to shut your emotions down. You have to become cold and ruthless.
Because they think, I run a story. We moved in this house here. We got this work surface. It's what is it, marble or whatever it is, travertine, wherever it is. And my wife put a pan on the actual surface. And my brother-in-law over here and his wife. And I said, "Don't put it on there." And he said, "Yeah, it'll burn the surface." And I said, "No, I don't want the kids getting it and knocking it." Knocking it on and burning themselves. So we both thought two totally different things at the same time. His was money orientated. Mine was worry about the kids running around getting burnt, right? That doesn't mean to say he's a bad person. I'm using that as an example. What I mean by that is that we all are driven by different things. And some people, I've met people like that in business, I'm sure you have, that will sit down and they just seem to stare right through. It's like they've been overtaken by this money parasite that takes over their decision making, that everything's viewed on how much can I get out of that? How much can I get out of that? When if they took that off the table, they'd probably still earn the same amount anyway.
I mean, as you're speaking that, I mean, there's a fascinating that it's from quite a few different books, but David Cameron, he says here in this book, where is it? And this is why it's really fascinating looking at later on. He says, this is, I only really knew I wanted to dedicate myself to politics and pursue a political career once I started working in it. But after that, I was in absolutely no doubt. It was a vocation, the only thing I wanted to do. I wanted to serve. I cared deeply about my country. I believed in public service, and I came to see and to believe profoundly that it is through political service that you can make the greatest difference. Now, it's fascinating to read that because in 2006 he gave his speech to get into the Tory party, said it's all about families. It's all about taking care of the family. And that's really got how he got into the Conservatives leadership, because people are like, yes, you know, it's not just about taking from people. But when he got in, he made a statement in 2010 that they would cut benefits by 5 billion. Do you know how much he cut and his government cut benefits by over that period of
No,
time?
no.
95 billion. So you see, on one level, like you said, they want to serve. Those are his words. I want to serve the people. But then what he actually did was the total opposite.
Which people is he serving?
Exactly, his class,
Yeah.
his friends. You know, and that's part of the trauma. And I think that's what I found interesting. People go, oh, well, it's conspiracy. It's like, no, have a look at it data-wise. If you just look at the data that, you know, if you look at trauma work of Gabor Mate or Peter Levine, they say the man who was hit as a child will feel compelled to hit as an adult. If the man who was held captive as a child will feel compelled to hold others captive as an adult, the man who was, you know, fill in the blank.
Unless that one person does what you've done, question everything, throw everything up in the air and question it. I did that in the 2000s. I do that all the time, to be fair. If you're willing to unravel things, which is it's difficult. It's not easy. I don't mean to say anybody who unravels it. What you're saying is that, yeah, my parents brought me up this way, which some people had a good life, but it isn't necessarily beneficial, if you like, because they were always arguing, or maybe they were fractious constantly. That's not how I want to live. But how do you make that change? And so Cameron can't make that change because he can't admit he's wrong. He's been brought up in that system that says, I can't admit I'm wrong. Because that's a sign of weakness. I'm going to get destroyed if I admit I'm wrong. Whereas you've gone through a process of admitting you're part of this problem. I have. I realize that my involvement in certain things was my doing, as much as the other person that did the wrong, if you like. Because I shouldn't have probably been with that person or in that environment in the first place.
And I think it's like what we learn in these schools is totally distrust of our own emotions. So our intuition, our hearts, you know, Jim Dethmer in his book about conscious leadership, he says there's three centers: the head, the heart, the gut. But at boarding school, you shut down the heart and the gut. It's like you just think. So it means you're missing 66% of the information.
Well, I would say that the experiments that they've done over time culturally, I mean, the big one obviously is the Operation Artichoke and MK Ultra and all these other that have now been, how can I say, micromanaged so much. They've got it so right now. They don't actually have to have somebody in a padded room anymore torturing them. They can do it en masse now and turn people into narcissists, if you like, if they see people who are doing selfies constantly walking around looking at themselves in their phone and what have you. Everyone's a modern day narcissist. If someone cuts you up in their car, they're the first to go defensive and stick tools out the window, you know, even if you're just giving them a slight warning that they might bump into you. Oh, blah blah, I'd be ranting and raving at you. Everybody's turning into that. I'm saying everybody, most people are turning into that person. Ironically, that's what got me on my road where I used to get angry in my car. And I thought, I've got to control this. This is just absolutely insane. But yeah, so people who, like Boris Johnson, will never admit they're up. Trump's a prime example. His mentor, Ray Cohn, it was called, he taught Trump never to admit you're wrong, never to admit failure. Always say you've won. And what are we seeing now? We've won. We've obliterated. What sort of talk is the stuff that's coming out of America at the moment from and from this country about we've obliterated them. We've blown all that up. I've never heard a president talk like that ever. Even Hitler didn't talk like that. There was a certain amount of call it professionalism or what have you. You that even if it was an act and a lie, at least they were acting and lying to you. You know, now they just tell you in America. We just obliterated them. Brilliant.
I think, Trump went boarding school at age 13, actually.
Yeah. And his father was apparently horrific. But most of these people are. I mean, I'm sure Gates's family, I mean, his mother, Mary Gates, didn't seem the nicest person. But she, her family, I think his granddad was one of the directors of the Federal Reserve, Bill Gates. So, you know, he's got a royal genealogy going back over here into England. I'm not saying the genealogy mean it means something because a lot of these people also, and I don't know if you've come across this. We did. I started when I did some work on the Beatles. And I never wanted to get into the Beatles research down that road, but I wanted an angle to find something interesting. And Richard Asher, who was Jane Asher's father, they obviously Paul McCartney lived there, and I found that an interesting angle to do some research. What I found was though that a lot of these people are not just high-end Masons, but actually have their own lodge. So the Elliot Lodge is Margaret Elliot, Jane Asher's mother's own lodge in Cornwall. And you find that a lot with the Boris Johnson, his mother, I forget the surname now, top of my head, the Fawcett Lodge in Cumbria. Now, does that mean anything? I'm not saying all Masons are bad people. I don't believe that for a minute. But obviously, the normal Mason probably just a normal guy or a woman. But up the echelons, the normal people hide. The other ones who are making certain decisions for us. I'm not saying it's just the Masons either, but it's another interesting thread that comes out through all this. Like they've all gone to boarding school, like they're all in some kind of lodge. I mean,
I was invited to a lodge myself, after I left boarding school, and it was like, "Do you want to join?" I'm like, "No, no, thank you."
I never liked clubs, so I don't, even when I played sport. I never went. I wasn't a drinker, so I never went drinking afterwards. So it was never a social thing for me going to clubs. So being a, I never got asked to be a Mason, but being a Mason would not have interested me. I always liked being an individual.
So, moving on to Tony Blair, what did you learn about
Do we
Tony
have
Blair?
to?
You don't have to, I
Yeah, no, I
guess,
just.
you know.
What did I learn about Tony Blair? Stuff I didn't realize, to be fair. We'd all when I first did the research back in 2021, I think it was, we'd all heard of his stuff after he was Prime Minister, but not necessarily a lot of what happened when he was before he was Prime Minister or before he was an MP. We heard story he was at the Bilderberger, going backwards. He was a Bilderberger, he was a young global leader, but it was actually called the Young Global Leaders of Tomorrow. That's what it was called. But they changed the name in 2000, I think. I think it was too obvious what they were trying to do with the name. They called it the Young Global Leaders as opposed to the Young Global Leaders of Tomorrow. Because a lot of the prime ministers and presidents that were became prime ministers and presidents during 2020 were Young Global Leaders. Trudeau, Macron, the German lady, I forget her name. I think Ardern was part of all this program. So a lot of these people who were prominent during 2020, in Klaus Schwab's own words, we've infiltrated the governments of the world. That's what he said. In Harvard, in an interview in Harvard. But yeah, going back to Tony Blair, I'd say Tony Blair's childhood was worse than Boris's. I actually sympathise with all the children who went to boarding schools, regardless of what they've turned out to be or who they are, whether it's Cameron or Johnson or Blair, because there is a point where you've got to say no one deserves that kind of abuse, even if it's just nothing happens to you and you're just in a dorm at 6 year old crying, right? No one deserves that. No one. I don't care who you are. Likewise, if you're in an abusive household living on a council estate, you don't deserve that either. And that turns out other people, doesn't it? In its own right. But Tony Blair, his family, his father is a strange story. His actual grandparents were vaudeville actor and actress. And his father was adopted by two Glaswegians, which is, again, it's not, there's no hidden story there. But that has to have some kind of trauma in itself, that the mother who adopted him, adopted his grandfather, his father, basically hid all the correspondence from his real mother. Destroyed it. So even his father went through trauma. Michael Gove's background is very similar as well. He was adopted.
I didn't know
And the
that.
same thing, yeah. And you tend to find these things are some of people are adopted who go into this, so they've got an even deeper separation. But Tony Blair, he went to school and he was another underachiever. He went to Coristers. I might have destroyed that
Yeah,
name.
Durham. Yeah,
Yeah,
Chorister School of Durham. Yes.
yeah. And his when his father had a stroke, quite a young age, he was sent back to school by his mother to board, to be consoled by the teacher, the priest, the headmaster, who had one-to-one meetings with him, but turned out to be a prolific child abuser.
That's Anthony Chevna
That's
Trent.
another. That were another one. That let me get
Okay.
this. Let me get this name. That was the last person, actually. Let me get this name.
That was
I think it was
the
called
former head of
Gove.
Eton, wasn't it?
That's correct. Yes, I think it was called Gove or Grove. The guy, that guy. But he the so he was sent to that school, and there was other people there at that particular time. Yeah, it was called Grove, John Grove or something like that. He was a priest, and he was the, I think he was, I'm sure he was the headmaster of that school at that time. But when he left there, he went to Fetters, obviously. And he hated Fetters, and you told a story. I don't know if you want to say it on here about him running away from Fetters. I didn't know this story.
I'm happy to share. I mean, my understanding is he hated his boarding school so much, he was put on a train at Newcastle to go back to school, and he was like, he didn't want to go. And so he got off the train again, and he caught either another train up to the airport. He got on a plane, and it was only when he sat down and the air hostess came up to him and says, "Where's your ticket? I didn't see your ticket." He says, "Oh, I'm running away." And this is, he's age 13 at the time. And you're like, I've heard of people running away, but, and what's fascinating is that in 1997, when he's going for prime minister and he wants, people to really like it, he tells that story on Michael, I don't know if it's Parkinson or Donahue or something,
Aspel, Michael Aspel, probably.
Michael Aspel, and Des O'Connor, I think it was Des
Right,
O'Connor,
right.
1980, 1997. In his book, his own biography, he doesn't even mention that story, and yet in that interview he says it's the most crazy thing he's ever done in his life. You would have thought in a 500-page book you would put the most crazy thing you've done in your life in your autobiography. He doesn't mention it.
That's because that comes with a certain, if you just say it flippantly on an interview, that's gone. But anybody who thinks like you, me, or other researchers would say, but why? Why would he run away? And how could he get on it? I mean, at that point, I presume it might have been a little bit easier to travel, but even then, there would have been checks and balances somewhere, I'm sure.
I mean, this is, if you think about it, it's like to run away, yes, and there's lots of people who have run away from boarding schools, you know. But to get on your plane and trying to go to Barbados, I think his father said, oh, he tried to go to
Were it
Barbados.
Barbados, right?
Something like that. And I think his father, that's what he said in the Des O'Connor interview. But his father said later on, oh, but there was no flights from Newcastle to Barbados. But yeah, you could quite easily, I don't know, you know, go down to London or what.
Well, that means something else as well. Either he just totally lied about that story, for instance, which shows another side of to him, and he doesn't want to mention it anymore because he said something there just to make him look rebellious, which seems to be a theme going all the way through his childhood, where they've made this persona where he's a rebel. He was a musician. He liked Mick Jagger, and one of the stories I read that he used to grease his hair with butter, to flatten his hair out. For some reason, I mean, I bet that were a sight. And they also said that he was some sort of pop promoter and promoted concerts. But I think that's oversold as well because him and the guy that he was doing the pop promoting with stacked shelves in a supermarket. So they made out that this pop promotion was like the next thing to organising an event at Wembley Stadium, and in reality, it probably wasn't that at all. And like the whole lives of Boris, it seems to be, and Blair, seem to be more lies than truths spoken about. And you've sort of got to sift out all these lies, if you like. But them on their own are a story, aren't they? Because these people are meant to be running a country. And if they lie, I mean, you could get away with lying because it makes no difference to millions of people's lives. But they can't.
It's that that's the thing is like yeah if you're traumatized and it doesn't it still affects your family but if you're suddenly in a position of power suddenly it filters down to so many people
Ask the
and
million Iraqis and Afghans who died about Tony Blair's lies and what they caused them. I mean, Mark Devlin points out that in his work that a lot of the musicians went through boarding school.
I
So
could
this isn't just a politics thing, is it?
no. I mean, have you Radiohead? They all went to Abingdon, which is the same boarding school as my father, and
Right.
there was big thing in the press because he was talking out when they became big about his headmaster and that they really didn't get on with him and he got fired, the headmaster.
Right.
But if you look at the lyrics for Creep, I'm a creep. I'm a weirdo. What the hell am I doing here? I don't belong here. You know, is he singing about boarding school?
I would
Is
say
he,
so.
you know, what's he singing about? And there's so many Supertramp. Their most famous song is about their time at boarding school. You know, and
It is a theme, isn't it? Nobody can get away from it. It's a thread. Whether, I mean, you speak from experience. I speak from an outside looking in, if you like. But it isn't that I've got anything. Again, I've state it again. I've not got anything against anybody, whatever school or background, color, race, creed. I'm not religion. I've got no. If you're a nice person, that's all that counts. You know, whatever nice means. But going back to choristers, Rowan Atkinson was in the same year, I think, as Tony Blair at the same school.
Really?
So a lot again. He's another one that acted. Obviously, he's an actor, but he had a speech impediment, so he used to put voices on to make himself. The only way he could talk more or less normally is putting voices on. An impersonation type thing, not living as him, which made it obviously made him a fortune, made him very famous, and he's very funny as well. But it shows that he's actually living a different persona as well as Rowan Atkinson.
Yeah, the mask.
Yes,
Putting a
the
mask
mask.
on.
Yeah, and he's actually been quite outspoken about certain things, hasn't he? Like freedom of speech, Rowan Atkinson. Maybe he's breaking that. Maybe he's broken through that mask, if you like.
Yeah, I mean,
But
was it Bottom? Aid Edmondson. he was beaten regularly at boarding school. And then you look at bottom, what was it? It was all about them being beaten and, it's violence. And it's like, oh, well, that's really fascinating.
Well, Fry and Laurie were the same. They did a like Jeeves and whatever it was. That was all really about that old upper class lifestyle. And even in Blackadder, when he played the general, that was all very sort of boarding school-esque humour, wasn't it?
So Stephen Fry, I mean, he went age 8, I think it was. And there's some fascinating stories in here, which he kind of, he says his he broke his arm at prep school, Stephen Fry. His brother broke his arm at similar time. And Stephen Fry fell off a swing. And everyone was like, oh, you idiot, falling off a swing, breaking his arm. His brother, well, he broke it playing rugby. So everyone's like, oh, well done, sir. Well, you took one for the team. And so Stephen felt really bad for years because it's like, well, I was a nonce, I fell off. But he found out years later that his brother didn't break it playing rugby. He broke it going into the kitchen because he was so hungry getting food. The porter threw him so hard that he hit these stairs and snapped his arm. But the school didn't tell you about that. Said, oh, no, it was done playing rugby. And it's like, yeah, just there's many stories like this in so many of these in these books. You're like, and I, what's fascinated me over the years. So I basically did like it was almost a double, triple blind study going into charity shops. My wife would be looking at, say, the clothes, and I would go and look at the books. And I'd pick a book up, biography, and I'd go, did they go to boarding school? I'm like, they did. And I'd buy it. And with each one, I'd go, is this one where basically it was pretty innocuous that nothing really happened? And I've got 60 biographies now. I've got one which is pretty innocuous, and that's Jack Whitehall. But all of the others, Gabriel Byrne, sexually abused, Roald Dahl, beaten pretty terribly. Ranulph Fiennes contemplated suicide because he was chased around Eton because he was a pretty boy. Whipped and beaten, expelled. David Niven. Richard Branson attempted suicide and was beaten until he bled.
I mean, Richard Branson's another interesting character because he's made out that everything started from nothing. Didn't have a privileged background and whatnot, and that's just nonsense, is that? That his mum had to sell a pearl necklace. I mean, me and Chris had a joke about that. I mean, saying was it a pearl necklace or was she acting in some kind of porno films getting a pearl necklace? But anyway, that's another story. But his whole life's a lie, Richard Branson, and everyone holds him up to be this business guru. And in 2020, he sold his soul because the government propped his businesses up, made emergency loans to Virgin Atlantic and all these other companies. So he was singing off the hymn sheet of the government to lock everybody down. And whether everybody listening believes that or believes that he's still a hero, I don't. Because none of these people, I mean, I don't know what your thoughts are on what happened in 2020, but the no one actually spoke out other than the narrative. Very few people. Matt Letizia is probably one person that spoke out who was famous for any length of time, and he paid the price for it. And that could be about any subject that goes against the narrative, whether it's speaking out about boarding schools. Me and you had a conversation on the phone, didn't it? What amazes me is that these people, when they get into these positions of power, none of them mention it. None of them talk about it. And you said to me, which was pretty, it said to me that my mind, where I was thinking about it, was wrong, that maybe they don't want to talk about it. And that's true. It's maybe they don't, or maybe that's the control mechanism within.
But it is interesting. You do say that in the book quite a bit, that if they went through this, which a lot of them did, why, once they got into power, are they not doing anything about it? It's like,
Maybe some of them didn't get abused, but even then, they must have gone to school Because I know, like, say, Michael Gove was at school where there was a teacher there that ended up being arrested and jailed. And he's never mentioned it. Now, I'm not saying he was abused or anything, but surely when you get in a position of power, it must have affected you, your friends, or whatever in your year. You'd have
Yeah.
thought, but yeah. So Boris Johnson's teacher was Canon Grove. That was at Choristers school.
So that's Tony Blair's at Choristers,
Yeah.
was Canon Grove.
Yeah, Canon Grove. And the headline in the Daily Star, I know, but it's still a mainstream newspaper. Pervert teacher comforted Tony Blair over poorly dad. So Tony Blair was, all right, former Prime Minister Tony Blair was comforted after his father fell seriously ill by a teacher suspected of child abuse. That's a headline in a newspaper. It's a pretty big story that whether it's true, he said the guy's died or passed away at that particular point. He died in 2001 at Canon Grove. But that's number one. That's the first person that we know of that Tony Blair apparently escaped the clutches of. He was one of the lucky few that was comforted by him in one-to-one meetings, yeah, but was never abused by him. Or supposedly never abused. And there were several teachers like this throughout his life, especially at FETs. I made the mistake of pronouncing it wrong once with my Yorkshire accent. And so, I think it's Fetters. Does it call it Fetters? Yeah.
Fetus,
I called it FET. So I apologize to every old FETsonians. But that school itself is, I mean, I know Nicky Campbell's come out and but one of the big
Ian
stories, weren't it, a
Wears.
few years? Yeah, anywhere. But I mean, if you look at Nicky Campbell and the way he talks to people, I would say he's got. I've never resonated with Nicky Campbell when I listened to him when I was younger. I would say because he's very, I'm better than you, and you can't answer my questions better. He's that type of character, that, or he comes across that to me that way. Maybe to other people, he's liked. But when you think about his background, it's not surprising that he's actually turned out like that.
Nikki Campbell's been really supportive of, the
Good.
work.
Yeah.
And he's, yeah, I think like the Ian Wears stuff, I think like it was Edinburgh
Where's
Academy as well. And just how many, and I think a lot of Ian Wears, I think, went to Edinburgh Academy and then went on to Fettes. And interesting, I did a rugby tour 1992, and who do we play rugby against? The Edinburgh Academy,
Right.
and it's just fascinating. And then, all of these different things. I got reached out. I reached out to a guy who'd done this documentary in New Zealand of a boarding school which had had a lot of abuse, and someone messaged me to say, "Oh, when I was at school, the head teacher came from this New Zealand boarding school to my school to look around." And it's like, and so it's like just the networks between these different schools
Yeah.
where a lot of abuse was going on, and often they would go, "Oh, here's one teacher, why don't you go and..." And often, as Alex Renton points out in The Secret Shame, is, the person who abused him got a reference and went off to another school.
Yeah. And you tend to find as well, I found that when Tony Blair came into power and when Boris came into power, there was abuse inquiries going on, or like there was the independent inquiry into child abuse at schools going on when Boris was. It started a long time before Boris got in, but there was a lot of stories in the
2014,
press. Yeah, there was a lot of stories in the press when he got into power. There were headlines: Boris's old school teacher accused of XYZ and what have you. Yeah, he never mentioned. I mean,
He mentioned it once. He says, "Why are we spaffing this money up the wall?"
exactly.
You're like, "What? You
Yeah,
can't talk about..."
and the only time he mentioned it, he was condescending to it, and so, and I don't know if you've got to that part in the book where I actually go through the people that were running the Independent Inquiry into Child Abuse, the Dame Wolf and people like that. Dame Wolf was a friend of Leon Britton.
Okay, right.
They had dinner parties together at their houses together. She admitted that she had to step down because of it. So, and if anybody didn't know, Leon Britton obviously apparently lost the dossier that Geoffrey Dickens gave him in the 1980s when he was in Thatcher's government.
And what was in the dossier that Geoffrey
It
Dickens?
was, well, John Wedger talks about it a lot, doesn't he? It might be something you could pick up with John because that was a ritual child abuse dossier of Dolphin Square. And Geoffrey Dickens was the MP for Huddersfield, ironically, and a Tory MP for Huddersfield. And he was basically blacklisted after that, was Geoffrey Dickens, as you can understand. Which led into the Raines list and all the other stuff that was going on at that time. The Raines list was, I forget her name now, but she was a psychologist that was interviewing people who'd been, who'd had a SRA, ritual abuse. And when she got to three people that mentioned the same name, or two people that mentioned the same, she put that on the Raines list. What they call the rain, and it's called the ritual abuse, blah blah. I forget the
Ritual
acronym, but
satanic abuse, is it something
yeah,
like that?
June something or other, she was called a doctor, and she got this massive list of people, and ironically, in Tony Blair's life, several of these people are on this rains list, from Margaret Hodge. Margaret Hodge was put in charge. She was Minister for Children, and she, before became the minister, she ran a local council. Let me get that out. I'm going to try and find that now. She ran a local council, Islington Council, and there was a whistleblower that came out, and basically there was 15 children's homes that was under investigation for abuse. And she basically said something. One of the guys that were abused, she basically said they were lying, even though there were 15 schools under her. And then she became Tony Blair's Minister for Children. And I'm not saying she's guilty of anything, of whatever, but when you see these threads running through, these are front page. By the way, I'm reading this from a newspaper story in the Standard. When Margaret Hodge led Islington Council, she knew about sex abuse in care homes under her control. This is a headline in the newspaper. It's not Don Watson making it all up. She's from the Oppenheimer. Her surname's Oppenheimer, and she. They own a company that apparently is worth 2.4 billion, or it sold for 2.4 billion, called Stemcor.
So, as you kind of looked and researched these different people, what was the central theme which really came out? What did you learn from writing the book? And
That there is a matrix, I suppose, and they use these people to control the matrix. And every 4 years, 8 years, these people leave, some new people come in, and they just carry it on. Doesn't matter whether they're red or blue or whatever, whether it's Nigel Mirage who gets in, and it's just going to be the same, as America's found out with Trump. You're getting two different parties, but they end up doing the same thing. They sell you a different, like David Cameron. It's all about the families. It's all about the families. Didn't tell you which families. Maybe it's
No.
the didn't tell you which people. I'm working for the people, but which people? They also seem to talk different languages to what people like us would talk. When somebody stood up, I mean, I would talk to a guy, one of the guys at the cricket. And he said, I said to him, he said to me, "You're right. These people aren't like us. They stand on a podium and talk about things like they are like us, but in reality, they're not like us."
No.
And They might look human, but they don't act as you expect a human to act. And a lot of people are noticing this stuff now. And that was a school teacher, by the way. He's a school teacher. And so people are noticing, you know, Middle England and people who are of normal working backgrounds are noticing that this isn't how it should be. Going back to how you're saying businesses should be run, you know, it shouldn't be Mr. Grimsdale anymore. It shouldn't be that. But I don't think I should answer the first question that the Tony Blair. In one of the chapters, Tony Blair, Satan's Little Helpers. I don't know if you got to. Have you got to that one?
Yeah, I have read
Yeah,
those
yeah.
bits. Yeah.
It was a hard. So John Rentoul wrote a book about Tony Blair, and he mentioned certain characters in that book that were at Fetter's teaching at the time when Tony Blair was there. And given the fact that we think that Tony Blair ran off, I mean, if somebody runs off, I would hazard a guess that they don't just run off once. I mean, I had people at our school ran off, and they were running off all the time.
Yeah, I don't know with Blair. I mean, I mean it's
That's
in
right.
here
Yeah.
where he
I haven't got
talks
it here
about.
now. Yeah. I had that book. I haven't got it here now. It's upstairs.
Yeah, I don't know. I think his father gave him quite a hard time or something like that. So whether he didn't do it, it was often seen for me at my school. You were one of the weak ones if you ran away. It was
Got
seen
you.
as a really bad thing. It was usually the crushed,
Right, okay.
and but some schools it was kind of seen as quite a cool thing that you managed to escape the prison. It's interesting listening to James, Tim Booth from James. He went to
Right,
boarding school,
right.
and in one of his interviews, he's saying that, you know, it was like they were prisoners. You know, people were trying to escape, and that's been a common theme if you look at most of them. John Peel, he talks about. Being inmates, Bear Grylls, prisoner, you know, Stephen Fry went to prison. He says, actually, boarding schools are just like prisons. You know, so whether he ran away once, whether he ran away more, I don't know. It's possible he did. I know that he probably, I know that he was breaking bounds and going into town.
Right.
But most of these schools are in the middle of nowhere, so it's very difficult to run away, whereas they were in Edinburgh. So it was
Right.
easier to jump the fence. And I
Yeah.
think he was doing that, you know, going and partying and,
Yeah. Well, they sell the story of him being a rebel, and being funny and having a girlfriend at Fetter's school as well, which it was there was they were going to expel him at one point from Fetter's.
Yeah.
And he went to live with his girlfriend's family for part of the last year. He saved him from being expelled, which I found another a very interesting story, especially that family's sort of background in politics and things like that. I think he's the guy's wife. He was a baron. I think he's Baron something or other. I mean, is this a normal thing? I mean, I've spoke to James Dellingpole about a lot of this stuff. I don't know if you spoke to James.
No, no,
I'm
no.
surprised he hasn't been in touch actually, and because obviously he went to boarding school, and he
Did
felt the
you?
odd one out as well.
No, yeah, no.
Yeah,
I've not heard of James. I've maybe have heard of James, but
he went to Oxford as well, and couldn't understand why he wasn't getting picked for all these things, but his father was. Probably a self-made man, and he didn't fit in with the background. He said, "I knew there were a guy there who were running at Oxford. I think this was who was part of the recruitment for MI5, and I wanted to know why he wasn't asking me to be part of this." He said, "Now, obviously, I'm glad that I weren't part of it, but he said I obviously had the wrong psychological breakdown of me or whatever." But yeah, so Fetters, he escaped. Several people at Fetters did Tony Blair. Selby Wright, he was the main one, Selby Wright, really. I don't know if you came across him.
I read it in your book, but I again, some of the names, again, what I did was as I was reading through your book, because I created a list
Oh, got
of
you.
all
Right.
the people in there, and then just how many went to boarding school. So I did quite a lot. So But I had obviously read Selby Wright in your book, but I hadn't heard of him before.
Well, I'd never heard of him until I did this work, and I wish I'd never heard of him, to be honest with you. But Tony Blair, in his final years at Fettes, ran summer camps for Selby Wright's boys' club. Now, Selby Wright had a, when he was younger, he had a, I might have got this wrong, but it's a 14-year-old boy living with him, who apparently adopted from a council estate or took in from a council estate. And he was known to be treated for a sexual disease, was Selby Wright, and the nurse fell in love with him until she found out he didn't like girls. He liked boys, but young boys. And it was well known throughout the school that he, and yet they allowed him to be in close contact. It's pretty horrific, isn't it? More than
Yeah, I
pretty
mean,
horrific.
I've heard this over and over again. I mean, at my school, people in Oxford and Cambridge, it was if you wanted to go into teaching and you liked young boys, then you should go and get a job at my boarding school. And I mean, six of my teachers have spent time in prison, another five were arrested later on. I've heard stories that it's like dozens more who haven't been prosecuted, and it's like hundreds of people. And Alex Renton says in the book, often one in nine people come forward, and it usually takes 27 years for people to come forward about sexual abuse. And you know, even then, there's only one in nine who will come forward. So you're suddenly, if there's 300 people have come forward, well, you're really looking at 3,000 or 2,700 or whatever. So, yeah, I mean, I just found it fascinating. I just think so many in your book, like Justin Welby, you talk about, you know, Justin Welby, his school, I think it was St. Peter's down by in Seaford, you know, one of the teachers, he was at boarding school from age eight, a paedophile. And he was arrested later on. What did the school do? They covered it up. So where did he learn to cover things up? You know, and he was similar that he was helping with summer camps with, forgotten the name of the guy now, but the guy who was whipping people from Winchester. So it's a common story throughout these schools and these institutions that there was abuse and you covered it up.
I mean, one of the headlines with Tony Blair got into power in May 1997. One of the headlines in the Times was Blair's school mentor was a sex abuser. Just as he's getting into power, is this a reminder, Tony, to do as you're told, or the information we have about you will be used against you as a as some kind of is this just to again get him to do what they want, the control in element want him to do? Maybe his rebellious side is questioning whether he can go along with it. And if he becomes prime minister, he can do what he wants. Maybe they're just reminding him, you can't, Tony. I mean, Selby Wright was the Queen's religious pastor or something. I forget what it was. He was the, he ran a, he worked for the intelligence during World War II doing the Radio Padre, where he was being BBC's Radio Padre across Europe, and he was putting obviously secret codes into the stuff he was talking, did Selby Wright as well.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Interesting.
So I think it was MI9, which was the propaganda arm of the intelligence unit.
Really? I didn't
Yeah.
know that. Yeah, I remember reading in your book, but I hadn't realized there was an MI9.
One of the weirdest characters in this book was the an Irish chap. Let me find his name. I'm digging through here because I don't I, like yourself. You don't remember everything, do you? Sir Knox,
No.
Samuel Knox Cunningham, he was called.
Yeah.
Knox to his friends. They owned the, I think it was John Player's Foot Cigarettes, and they owned a big that became part of British America Tobacco. So they were quite high profile in Northern Ireland, Ulster unionists and Orange men, things like that. And he was an ex-Fetters. He was the president of the old Fetsonians or something like that, and he
Yeah.
got basically free rein to come in and have one-to-one meetings with the boys. And Tony Blair was one he took a liking to, by the sound of things. And in that book you've got there, by is it John Rental?
John Rental, yeah.
He mentions Knox Cunningham, so in that book. But I think in the later editions it's been scrubbed, I think.
Really?
Yeah, somebody.
Wow.
I don't know if it has, because I haven't got a later edition. I've only got that older edition I bought,
Yeah, I've just got
the
the
canal one.
same older edition. Yeah, I do remember them talking about Knox Cunningham in here.
I mean, but Boris Johnson's family, his great, was it his great grandfather, great great grandfather, he was the one that started the YMCA, the Young Men's. He was the founder of the YMCA.
Wow.
George Williams, I think it was
Okay.
called. Yeah, Sir George Williams.
Yeah, this bit in here, page 18, Tony Blair's book. Cunningham was the sort of man who liked boys but never did anything about it, as far as I know. But that was what he was about. Cunningham liked to go through the boys' quarters to provoke them with his outrageously reactionary views and encourage them to challenge school rules. Robert Philp, house tutor at Arniston, said he used to come back rubbing his hands with glee, saying that stirred things up a bit. Blair loved arguing with him. So, yeah, it's.
I mean, for someone to escape so many known abusers, because the Cunningham was also linked to the Kinkora boys' home scandal in Ireland,
Ah, of course, yeah.
and he was a known intelligence asset of whether it was the British intelligence or the Ulster Constabulary, but he was a known intelligence asset, and he would have been made to be quiet, and that was linked to a Ulster Defence guy. I forget his name. Let me look it up, because now I've started talking to it about it. I've got to. There's been books written about this. I mean, Martin Dillon wrote several books, one called Trigger Men, and another one called The Dirty War. A guy called Chris Moore has written throughout his career, an ex-BBC reporter, written about the Kinkora scandal and Kinkora's Britain's shame. That's a recent book, that actually, 2025, he wrote that.
Well, that heard.
He
I
wrote
mean,
about that.
obviously, I've heard of Kinkora's scandal in the school.
So yeah, he was linked to all these people. McKeague, who was part of the Ulster Defence Forces and a known hitman as well, and he was known for basically running torture rooms, and he was a known member of this scandal, and he was, I think Cunningham bailed him out, or it was something like that.
Yeah, so it's like, so what you're kind of seeing is like this matrix, as you,
Mosaic, or whatever you want to call it, of
yeah, you've put it
people
together.
that are involved in abuse that were close to Tony Blair and the royal family.
Yeah, it's interesting, as you were sharing about Selby Wright. There was a guy who used to come to my school called Bishop, I think it was Peter Ball, and he used to come, and he would, when kids were really unhappy, they would be sent off to Peter Ball and he would sexually abuse them. And during the ICSA, there's articles out there of the people he abused. And when I think the police tried to question him, I think Charles sent a letter to the police or something like that, just saying, oh no, he's a, like vouching for him. And because they'd had family connections with Peter Ball or something like
In
that.
fact,
So,
don't dig too deep, please. That's probably more likely why what went on. Because this Kinkora Boys' School goes back to the Mountbattens as well. Apparently,
yeah.
boys were taken to the Mountbattens Castle in island.
Right. Yeah. I think John Wedger does talk about similar things in Scotland in some of the homes there, and I know that Jimmy Savile was involved in some of the homes, certainly the girls' homes. So.
Another guy at Dunblane was involved. Well, it seems like he was involved in, like, it wasn't the scouts, but he used to take boys in summer camps as well in Scotland.
So I'm aware of time, and you've got a
Yeah.
cricket match to go off to. And I'd love, as we start to wrap up, what would be a final thread or a final thing that you'd like to leave with the listeners here?
Is it going to be positive or?
Well, I'd love to leave on an
Yeah.
uplift, because that's really my vision is with leadership, is that, we bring this to light so we can let it go and then move forward.
I suppose with leadership, it's a difficult one, isn't it? Because it, again, anybody who, what is it to say? If a politician wants to be a politician, they're probably the wrong person to be a politician. And I think in business, you're only the leader because you own the business, if you like. Yeah, you're not being voted in to do it. It's two different types of things, isn't it? Although they can run it the same positive way or negative way. So I don't class myself as a leader.
Can I class you as a leader
I
then?
don't know if you want to, but I'm reluctant to do that because I think if you think yourself as a leader, you think you're better than people, and I don't think I'm any better than anybody else. We're all got traits where we're better at things than other people and crapper at things than other people. So my wife brings me down to earth if I get a bit above myself, I suppose. But yeah, but you know, one of your questions, you call hope for the future. And I think it's having spent researching corruption and what have you. I've not seen anything. And again, this sounds negative, but for me, I'm an observer in all this. Yeah, I think there's a, if anything it's taught me is that there's a bigger thing playing out than any human can get a grasp of. That's the thing that it tells me, that where it is something, I'll say divine, I'm not a religious person, but I would say it's something otherworldly that's controlling this, that's bigger than all us. That's one thing when I went through 2020, I realized, and even though we're looking at this stuff since I were a kid, I started reading JFK books in the 80s when we were about 18 or 17 or something like that. I was just intrigued into what it was all about. And 2020, though, taught me that there's something bigger happening than Boris Johnson or Tony Blair can ever control. If there's anything positive to take out, that we're, even though we're only small people, a small piece of this, we're obviously part of something really powerful, and positive and warm, yeah. And maybe this is just some kind of torture, incubator or something that we've got to experience.
It's a beautiful message to leave on, like positive that, well, bless you for your work and what you're doing to bring this to light. I think it's so important. It's just to have conversations. I think that's what my wife was very much about. It's like, let's have these conversations. She introduced me to John Wedger's work, and it's like, oh wow. And I didn't want to listen to it. She says, no, you're going to sit down and you're going to listen to this. I'm like, oh, this is really painful. It's like, and it's, I think it's important for us just to bring this to light. Do we agree with it? Do we don't? Doesn't matter. Let's bring this to light and find the information. And I love, your book that you've got so many references. I mean, like you said, it was what, nearly 200 pages. It's like, wow, you've done your research. So bless you. Bless you for your
Thank
work.
you.
And if I
Thank
can
you.
support you in any way, being in Halifax, that you're about 20 minutes away from me,
And
and I didn't realize that.
hopefully we'll have a coffee at some point or a
Yeah,
cup of tea
maybe.
or whatever. Yeah.
Yeah, definitely. I'd love that
Yeah.
to meet up, and let's. Yeah, I'll come to the event in a couple of weeks and
Yeah, do that.
meet you in person.
Yeah. And my brother, Mark Devlin's going to be there as well.
Okay.
And John Hamer.
Okay, great. I don't know John Hamer. I obviously watched your interview with Mark Devlin. But yeah, well, bless you and thank you so much. And
Thank you.
please do, people, listeners, have a read of Dom's book, Traitors. I'll put a link into the description. What's the best way of getting it?
You can get it on Amazon or traitors-2020.com. I set a little website up there where people can get it if they want to get it from direct.
Okay, great. I'll put a link into the description for that. Cool. Right.
Thanks,
Blessings,
Piers.
Dom.
Yeah,
Take
cheers.
care. Bye-bye.